Welcome to Speech Scope, a MedBridge podcast where we conquer challenging topics for the medical SLP. Our aim is to deliver actionable takeaways for clinicians like you through captivating discussions with experts in our field. To receive continuing education credit for this episode and access bonus resources, make sure to check out MedBridge.com. Hello, I'm your host, Sarah Barr, a clinical SLP in Michigan with over 15 years of experience. I specialize in adult neurogenic disorders and the life participation approach. Today, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Williams Wood, an expert in the area of aphasia. We'll be diving deeper into the topic of global aphasia, including recent research and actionable takeaways you can implement right away. Welcome, Treasure. I'm so glad you're here. Could you get us started by sharing a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you, Sarah. I'm excited to be here with you today, especially talking about one of my favorite topics, aphasia. As you mentioned, my name is Dr. Treasure Williams Wood. I am a speech language pathologist. I am originally from Michigan. I obtained my Bachelor of Science in Speech Language Pathology from Western Michigan University, go Broncos. Woo-hoo. And then I completed my master's degree in Hampton at Hampton University, and finally completed my clinical doctorate in speech language pathology at Northwestern University. I currently live in Chicago, Illinois, on the south side, so I am a Sox fan with my husband and my rambunctious little terrier, Elliot.
Love to hear it. I would love to hear, you've had such an awesome career so far, so I would love to hear how you got interested in the topic of aphasia and maybe more specifically global aphasia, some of your clinical experience, like what attracted you to working with this population.
Absolutely. So I have worked across the entire continuum of healthcare as a medical speech language pathologist, from acute care to inpatient rehab. I've worked in rehab settings and outpatient. And I think one of the first things that attracted me to working with individuals with aphasia was having the opportunity to do a clinical fellowship in a split placement, which means it was split half-time at a skilled nursing facility or at a continuing care rehab community. And then I was also in an outpatient office. So I really got to see how aphasia and post-stroke care impacts an individual from the time they're in a rehab facility all the way until they discharge to the home environment, but still need that support and still are dealing with the ramifications of having their stroke and having that impact their ability to communicate. And so after I completed my medical clinical fellowship experience, I worked in those settings for a few years. And, you know, I decided that I wanted some adventure, and I became a travel speech language pathologist and went all over the country. And I always found that aphasia was the great equalizer in terms of social determinants of health and healthcare outcomes. You know, I noticed that there were a lot of differences regarding other diagnoses, but my patients with aphasia were all experiencing the same real challenges, regardless of where I was in the country. And so travel therapy led me to Chicago, where I set up shop and began working in the number one rehabilitation hospital in the country, Shirley Ryan Ability Lab Hospital. And I had the pleasure of working on their stroke floors, on their TBI floors, on their medically compromised unit floors, and then ultimately in their outpatient neurology office. And that is where I got this robust experience being able to work with patients with all types of aphasia, but really seeing the most difficult and challenging cases, which were the global aphasia cases, right? These individuals who had gone to all of these other hospitals, but really had to come to Shirley Ryan Ability Lab because no one else could help them. And then most recently, I was a founding clinic director at a free clinic in Chicago, and I began teaching aphasia at the university level before establishing my own private practice in Southside Chicago, where I provide aphasia therapy and support to individuals who need it.
Fantastic. Wow. I love to hear about all the clinical experience you've had and just the things that you noticed that helped you kind of follow that passion more closely and at different levels for people with aphasia. So before we dive into the good stuff here, let's just start with a high level, just making sure we're on the same page when we're talking about global aphasia. So this is really a special clinical population. Let's talk about an overview of what this is and really what are the challenges that clinical SLPs are facing when we're working with people with global aphasia.
Sure. I think it's so important to have that preliminary operational definition of what global aphasia is and to recognize how special and different it is. So, you know, there are different levels of severity in terms of language disorders and types of aphasia, but global aphasia is certainly a severe language disorder, and it results from extensive damage to the language areas of the brain. It's typically caused by a stroke or a traumatic brain injury, but sometimes we could see it as a result of injury after a brain infection or some type of rare disease process. But the majority of cases that we see with global aphasia are as a result of a stroke or some type of traumatic brain injury. And what makes global aphasia so severe and so unique is that, unlike other aphasias where maybe just one or two or three processes of language are affected, global aphasia affects all aspects of language. So that includes comprehension and expression, a person's ability to repeat, their ability to read and write. And so this discussion is so important because global aphasia presents some real unique challenges when clinicians are trying to assess it and then when they're trying to build an intervention plan. And so as speech-language pathologists who are working with patients with global aphasia, we really have to tailor our approaches to support communication and really understand the impact on quality of life for our patients, right? Because, you know, if a person has all of their aspects of language, then it can be really difficult to assess them in the traditional way. And it's also really difficult to establish functional communication goals because everything is impaired, right? Or it feels like everything is impacted.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, you know, the people that end up having global aphasia, it's so different than our other aphasia clients because you're kind of looking for that strength and then building on it. But sometimes it feels like, well, what do I do if I didn't find a strength? Like, where do I even start? So I'm glad we'll get to dive into our clinical process. Like, what do we do in the assessment and intervention? So as we get into our clinical practices, we know that we like to use the latest research to figure out what we should be doing. Can you give us a high-level summary about what are some of the key takeaways we should be keeping in mind, or like what questions should we be asking as clinicians, or maybe things we should be questioning at this point?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say there are five things that the latest research is telling us that should inform our practices when we're treating those with global aphasia. The first one is to focus on individualized and functional communication goals in lieu of impairment-based goals. So instead of looking at what someone can't do and just kind of trying to fill that hole and remedy their impairment, we want to see what is functional and what is salient to the patient. And then the second is embracing the use of augmentative and alternative communication, or AAC, strategies. And this doesn't have to be fancy, right? It can be low tech, high tech, but understanding that AAC is a huge, huge tool that we can use in supporting this population. And I think placing an emphasis on that intensive, repetitive, and meaningful practice so that we are building those neurons and really abiding by the laws of neuroplasticity. And so, you know, practice doesn't make perfect. Perfect repetitive practice makes perfect. And then finally, looking at different technology-based interventions that may not have been traditionally used in speech therapy, but are available easily and are acceptable to our patients.
Awesome. Well, I love those. And let's keep those in mind as we then move into how do those kind of key takeaways actually look when we're doing assessment and then intervention. So if you're okay with it, let's start by talking through the assessment time. So here we go. When you have someone who you may consider them to be globally aphasic, what are the types of tools that you're using within your assessment for those clients? Or like, how are you discovering that?
Yeah, so I use a combination of standardized assessments, and then I rely heavily on dynamic assessment approaches. So, you know, just as a mini explanation, a standardized assessment is, you know, your big test batteries that are normed on a population and have a specific protocol, and you have to follow it to the T. And your dynamic assessment is you as a clinician, you know, creating a criteria and then assessing how your client moves through it and taking notes and really individualizing it to their strength. Now, most people would say, well, man, if, you know, how can you use something like the WAB or the Boston Diagnostic Aphasia Evaluation if it is standardized and you have to follow the process to the T? And the thing is that we're using it in a different way to gather information. If we know that someone is impaired across comprehension, expression, and all of these modalities, we know that they may not understand the directions, but that can still give us information about how to work towards their strengths. And then in terms of dynamic assessment approaches, I really enjoy things like the famous people assessment. I also rely heavily on supportive conversation strategies to confirm comprehension in terms of yes and no, and in terms of interest. This is also where I do rely heavily on the care partner and family to get a list of individualized preferences so that when I am trying to distinguish certain things to see if they are able to recognize objects or name things to see if it is resonating with them on the assessment.
Yeah. Okay. Let me go back and just make sure I'm understanding, because I really liked the point you made about the standardized assessment. So let's use the Western Aphasia Battery, for example. Sometimes those clients with global aphasia, I mean, you might start doing some of the sections of that test and they're just like totally not getting it, right? But what you're saying is, so let's say you're, you know, trying to do the object naming part and they're not getting it. But you might then choose, you know what, I'm going to write the word also. As I show them this pen, I'm going to add the written word pen.
Yep.
And so even though you're not completing the test in the standardized
right.
way.
Right, it's no longer standardized. Yep.
Yes, you are still, as the speech pathologist, getting critical information that's going to help you make a plan. Is that like what you're saying with that example?
Exactly. Yep. That's exactly it. And then maybe then I'll do that and I'll make a note, you know, okay, when I added that written support, man, still didn't happen, so that I know and I can put that in my notes, or I'll put that, you know what, it worked then. And then I would carry that over and then also consider an alternative method like observation in a naturalistic setting. So right. Maybe I would observe the patient and see if, you know, if they went to write something, would they know if, and all there was a pen and a cup, would they reach for the pen? Would they reach for, you know, would they have that connection and things like that? Or if a person had two things in their hands and they held them out to them to write something, would they know to, you know, choose the pen? If I said, which one is the pen? If I had a label with a pen on it in a naturalistic form, would mm-hmm. they do that? So I would kind of trial it multiple times across a naturalistic setting as well as within the assessment setting.
I like that. In a way, it kind of feels like you're shifting, like, okay, this person is not doing well if we're doing the standardized impairment-based test. But if I shift my focus to what strategies, like what supports are helpful, then that is a very valuable part of the assessment. And that's really what you're getting when you're doing that dynamic assessment.
Yep. And that's the part that you want to list in the report, right? Because when you're treating someone with global aphasia, you know, we really don't care about how impaired things are because we know that everything is impaired. What we really want to see is what made a difference. What made it better? What made it worse? What didn't do anything? That's a critical, critical part of the evaluation.
So tell me, just in case our listeners haven't heard of, you mentioned the famous people protocol, and I'm not sure everyone would have heard of that. Can you just tell us a little bit about that task?
Yeah, it's a really cool task. It's a protocol where essentially you present the patient with a series of pictures of really well-known celebrities, and you probe them to see if they can tell you who it is, if they can describe it. And the reason that I love using this with people who are globally aphasic is because sometimes, you know, they'll look at a picture of Michael Jackson, and they'll start humming one of his songs, and you'll know, okay, you know who this is, right? You might not be able to say the word, but you know who this is. Or you might show them a picture of a celebrity, a former president or something, and they might purse their lips in a way that you can tell they're mouthing the initial phoneme of their name.
Wow.
And so it gives you a lot of information about what their brains are calling up in terms of a semantic relationship to naming versus a phonemic relationship to naming and how those connections interact. Another really good assessment I like comes out of Arizona. It's a semantic relations test. And it's more of a dynamic assessment. And what it does is it's all pictures, and you're asking the patient to choose a picture out of, I believe it's a field of four, that best connects to the picture in the middle. So if you have a picture in the middle that is of a spider, and then the field is a web, a door, a car, and a tie, which one correlates more strongly to the spider? And you hope that they pick web, right? And so then you're able to see what their semantic strengths are without putting the burden of verbal expression and following commands and doing some of the rote tasks that are normally involved in standardized testing.
Love it. So let's move to goal setting then. Once you've gotten the information that's valuable for what you need for the client, what are these goals looking like? When they're so severely impaired, you know, it's like, okay, where do I even start when everything is not working well? How do you wrap your mind around that?
Ruthless prioritization. is what I refer to it as, ruthless prioritization. You want to prioritize goals that target basic communication needs, such as making their wants and needs known. And you really want to focus, again, not on fixing an impairment, but improving their overall communication effectiveness. So it's really not about the accuracy, it's about the effectiveness. Did this person effectively get their point across? Were they effectively able to participate? And then finally, you really want to make sure that you involve them and their care partner in the goal setting, because if it's not relevant to them, they will not buy into it, right? And that's all of us. And so in order to ensure that it's something that we have a commitment to, that they're practicing outside of therapy, you want to make sure that the care partner and the patient is involved and that they really have ownership of their goals.
Oh, that's great. And I love from the life participation approach, just that simple but really impactful focus on, hey, you know what? It doesn't really matter if they are saying the word out loud, but if they start to like point to something that they want and they weren't doing that before, their communication effectiveness has improved. And that we can call that a win.
That's something to celebrate. Yeah, we call that a win. And really is, you know, shifting it from, oh, you got 3 out of 10 correct versus, hey, you were able to point to which muffin you wanted at the bakery and you got it.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's what life is about, right? Ordering the muffin you want.
Yes, I love that. Oh, that's good. Okay. So if we're going to think about our interventions and incorporating evidence-based intervention, what should we be thinking about specifically for the global aphasia population? Again, kind of what comes to mind for me is that same feeling with setting goals is, okay, there's so many things I could do. How do we think about prioritizing needs when we're choosing which evidence-based intervention to use?
Yeah, I think, you know, implementing a multimodal approach is really important. And so combining your traditional therapy techniques with AAC strategies and understanding that both can serve a purpose. You don't have to just rely on the traditional therapy techniques of, you know, that just drill. And, you know, using AAC to support communication can facilitate improvement. Also emphasizing that, you know, you and your client are not going to be spending a lot of time together, right? Really, the practice and the frequency of practice is going to be outside of the therapy room. And so when you're in therapy, of course, you want to emphasize frequent and intensive practice sessions, but you want your client and their care partner to understand that everything they do should be an opportunity to practice effective communication, because neuroplasticity says that in order to make those new neural synapses, things have to be frequent, they have to be intense, and they have to be salient. And so in order for that to happen, the patient and their care partner really do have to be committed to doing the work outside of therapy. And that's why we individualize the interventions based on their needs and their abilities, because we want it to be something that when they leave therapy, they can do when they're grocery shopping, or they can do when they're at home putting the dishes away. So it's specifically tailored to how they live their lives.
Yeah, I like that. Even how you might be framing that practice to the family, it feels a lot different when you embed it in their life, right? Where you're like, hey, you're going to the grocery store every week, and here's a specific way you can act within the store so that the client gets some practice. That feels a lot different than, hey, here's a pack of papers, or here's an app. Make sure you put 20 minutes in. And I really like that. Do you have like a general rule of thumb or maybe information on how many hours you try to get these clients to practice in a week?
So I don't go by hours. I actually go by opportunity. So the first thing that I do when I am doing an intake for a client is I'll sit down with them and say, tell me what a typical day looks like in your schedule. And then I ask them to bring their calendar or bring their planner or whatever they use. And I ask them what their week looks like. And so if I see them once a week, we have a moment where we do look over their schedule and we look over what communication opportunities are in your schedule that we can take advantage of. And so will look at the schedule and they'll say, okay, so you go grocery shopping on Thursdays. Let's make that an opportunity. Oh, and you're going to go to the bank on Friday. All right, how can we practice this? Okay, and looks like you're going to go pick up your dry cleaning on this day. And then you're going to over to your daughter's house and you're going to visit with your grandchildren for a little while. All right, so grocery store we have. How long do you spend in there? Okay, about 45 minutes. Okay, and then you order things, you know, and so I think that is really how you tap into that saliency and that commitment. And I'll make a checklist. And so we'll say, you know, for the care partner, okay, grocery store, goal is to tell the guy at the deli, you know, or communicate how much lunch meat you want and to be able to pay at the checkout line. Okay, when you go to pick up your dry cleaning, the goal is this. And, you know, we make these target goals. And so it's less about getting the time in and more about seeking out and using these communication opportunities to practice.
Oh, that's honestly wonderful to hear. I love that framework, and I think that's like a new way to think about it. So thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah. And then, you know, just to add, I think it helps as well at the end of therapy, because then you're tracking when you're taking data and you're saying, okay, right now you mentioned that you have to go to the grocery store, the dry cleaner, you have to go visit your grandkids. These are the things that you do on a daily basis and they're not going well right now. And then at the end of therapy, you have this systematic way where you check in with them and you can say, look at how you've improved your ability to participate in these things. Or even though we've made this progress, we still have three or four things that we want you to be able to participate in. So now let's go to your insurance company and tell them, no, you have not plateaued. No, you know, you actually are getting better. You just need to be more independent. And so we should keep going with therapy.
That's wonderful. And honestly, not just the client and their family, but really for us as speech pathologists, seeing that type of progress, like that's why we do this. So that's wonderful. I wanted to do like a little kind of tangent here and have a chat about cognition skills and global aphasia, because this is one of the things I think I feel some internal tension sometimes with this population, because, you know, we always want to promote competence. And we have the saying, you know, aphasia does not affect intelligence. And at the same time, it is possible that people with global aphasia may have had their cognition affected. And so I just want to know your thoughts on how can we support cognitive changes with the global aphasia population, or like how do you balance kind of that tension with those things?
Yeah, I think it's definitely tension, right? Because it's kind of hard to figure out sometimes which came first, the chicken or the egg, which came first, was it a memory issue or was it a language issue? And, you know, then you have things being confounded with cognitive communication and aphasia already being confused with a level of intelligence. And so it can really be a dignity issue, right, with our patients and their caregivers, especially in how they characterize it, because sometimes they don't understand, oh, this person is a word-finding issue. Okay, they forgot. And so it can get really murky. And so I think for me, I just like to integrate cognitive communication tasks into the language therapy sessions. So for example, the example I gave you just before we were talking about the picking up the dry cleaning and going to the grocery store, those are all executive functioning tasks, right? And so we are incorporating these communication opportunities, but then we're also saying, let's do an executive functioning task where we plan and sequence and reflect, right? And be inhibited and, or, you know, show initiation and problem solve so that we can communicate. And I found that to be really helpful. And then also implementing compensatory strategies to support cognitive deficits, for example, you know, with paying attention, you know, breaking things up into smaller chunks, you know, with therapy, not overloading the patient with too many things to focus on at once, right? Making sure that they're able to focus on what they can, and then really incorporating those metacognitive strategies. So thinking about their own thinking, saying, how are you going to remember this? How are we going to keep track of all this? Because you have a lot of doctor's appointments and this is a lot. So I always make sure that my patients have a therapy binder that they are able to bring to and from therapy. We make sections in it. It could be, you know, their practice sessions. It could be their education sections. So they have that guideline of organization. And then finally, really monitoring for changes in their cognitive status and checking in with the family so that you can adjust intervention accordingly.
That's great. Do you ever find with clients that you end up having to do more like totally like nonverbal stuff first to like get a handle on the cognition and then move? Or are you pretty trying? Okay. I didn't know if maybe always trying to put things in a context where you are getting cognition and communication.
You can get cognition and communication nonverbally as well, right? Because you can look at how a patient organizes things. You know, I really love to follow their lead, right? You can hand a patient a stack of pictures and begin modeling something for them and see how they follow your model. And then you can fade your prompts and see if they can recall the model, right? And that's something you can do without even verbalizing or speaking to them. And that can give you so much information about their ability to comprehend within a context and outside of a context.
That's wonderful. Okay. So my next question then is about care partner training. We know that care partner training is key, as you've mentioned. I mean, we as the speech pathologists are not with our clients the most in the week. Their care partners are. In my experience, one of the troubles that I run into is, on the one hand, I know about neuroplasticity. And then on the other hand, when I'm dealing with like the real person in the care partner, sometimes it's a situation where like I'm thinking about a care partner spouse that first they're just learning about global aphasia, and then additionally they're learning how to manage all of the household tasks like paying bills, insurance, dealing with insurance companies, doing all the transportation. And so I was wondering, for those like most tricky situations that do pop up, do you have suggestions about how to approach that whole family dynamic in a successful way that supports really both people?
Yeah, you know, and I think the thing is the perspective. As a speech language pathologist, I don't look at the client in a singular way. I am treating the whole family, right? And so I'm working with this family, right? And so the client may be, you know, the core connection. And I always say, when folks have aphasia doesn't happen to one person. It happens to the entire family and their entire communication network, right? Because everyone has to adjust. So it's so important to provide education and training to the care partners on the communication strategies and reinforce that, let them practice, right? And so it's really not about us, because we already know we know how to do it. You know, we might train something new with the patient, but then I want to say, all right, now let's bring your spouse in here and let them practice prompting you so we can build their confidence as well, because they're really your eyes on the ground. And, you know, you have to look at the family, as you said, as whole people, right? People that are likely never imagined they would be in this situation. They're overwhelmed. They may have relied on this communication partner for management of household tasks or things, and now they're having to learn a lot of new things, right? And so you really have to be able to offer that counseling and emotional support so that care partners feel like they have resources, right? One of the things that, you know, I say a lot to my families are, you know, we are your dream team. So if we need to add some people to the team to help support you, our only job is to make sure that you and your loved one are successful. So do we need to find you a social worker? Do we need to get a caregiving agency that can give you a little break so you can go get your nails done or you can go watch the game a little bit and have that little break? And then really encouraging open communication and between the person with aphasia, their care partners, and the healthcare team. And this can be really challenging because sometimes you can spend a long time devising this brilliant plan that you are so proud of yourself, and the family says, nope, that is just not going to work. We do not like that. And so we have to be humble enough to check in regularly and say, am I meeting your needs? Is this working for you? Do you like it when we have your spouse prompt you in this way? You don't like it. Okay. Do you like it when we train them on this device? Oh, you don't like it because it's really difficult for you to carry around. Okay. And we have to be very collaborative and encouraging of that feedback as providers.
That's beautiful. What's coming to mind is the stark difference. Everything you just described is from really how I was trained at the beginning of my clinical care. And so I'm just going to say some of the examples, maybe for anyone else listening. When I was trained, we even, especially for someone like with global aphasia who had a lot of deficits, we would say to the spouse, hey, it's actually best if you wait in the lobby while we do therapy, because I really need their full attention. And then, you know, maybe the last like 5 minutes they would get invited in and we'd kind of give the report. But, you know, what you're saying here, it's so beautiful because it's about seeing the whole family as the unit that they are, and that you have to work within that dynamic to be successful for the client. So it wouldn't be really appropriate to not invite the family in. And you're even saying it's part of therapy to use your time to train the caregiver. So thank you for that. That's really some awesome advice. I love what you've said here. Let's take it a step further and just make it really real for the audience by applying it to a couple real world examples or case scenarios.
Yeah. So let's talk about one that I loved. I worked with a wonderful family. It was a woman who had a stroke and had global aphasia and actually had at least 11 children. Pretty incredible, right?
Yeah.
And so I think she had more than 11, but, you know, and it was really a testament in culturally responsive care because in their culture, the family, all the family came together to care for a loved one. And so, you know, different children, different siblings were assigned, and there was never a session that I had without at least one child present, right? Because for me, again, I am treating the entire family. And so when we looked at basic needs, the first thing I did was I took an inventory of their communication, right? So what are the things that she needs to be able to express? Foods, basic needs, using the bathroom, clothing, things like that. And what I would do is they did not have, you know, iPads or computers, but everybody had a cell phone. And so every time a family member would come, I would use that core vocabulary list of maybe one. We started off with one syllables, and then we moved to two syllables and multisyllabic words. I would slowly record my mouth saying their names. So if their names were Bob or Bobby, I would record a video of just saying Bob, Bobby, and doing that 3 to 5 times, and then making essentially practice video libraries that they could, when there was their day to be with mom, they could practice that core set of words, or no, or saying more, or saying, you know, bread or coffee, right? And so they were all able to be a part of that practice because even though they may not have had the cueing perfect, they could just pull up that video and they had me in their phone. And, you know, I swore them to secrecy to never share these videos because I did not have the best hair day in some of these videos, but to, you know, zoom in on my mouth. And so they were able to practice. And that is really basic AAC. And then with the functional communication strategies we developed, one of them, we noticed that the mom was really stimulable for cueing. In terms of using a hand gesture. So we actually sat down and for every single family member, we made, and this was a full family effort, we made a hand sign for every single family member. And so if there was a family member that was really kind, they would, she would rub her hand on her heart and we would practice doing that and doing the motor movement and calling up that name. And if I rubbed my hand, eventually the mom would go, oh, that's Sasha. I'm just making these names up. That's Sasha. Or if there was one and their name was Mary, we would put our finger on our lips so we knew that, that's Mary. So that phonemic cueing. And then after a while, they could talk to the mom and if the mom wanted to tell them which child or which sibling that she was talking about, she could put her finger on her lips and go, and they would go, Mary, yep. Or she would rub her heart and they would go, oh, Sasha, okay. And so they all had this communication system.
That's beautiful. It's personalized, it's individualized to the client's skills. And I love how then each of the family members just had this built-in time to not only give the practice for the client with aphasia, but in a way it was training them too, right? How to best communicate. That's wonderful. Do you have one other clinical example you could share?
Sure. I had a client a while back who I think is such a microcosm of what we see in our practice with this population, where we have a care partner that is just overwhelmed with their responsibilities. You know, this was a younger couple and the spouse had had a stroke. Both of them were still working. And so they were just really overwhelmed with the responsibilities, right? Because if you go from being a couple that both of you get up and go to work every day, you do your thing, your spouse does their thing, and then everything suddenly is on you. And not only are you supporting your spouse, but now you're also supporting the household because you're the only one that's able to work. And so one of the things that we were able to do was we knew that, you know, this person had to have transportation because the care partner had to work. It was just unrealistic to expect them to be brought into therapy. And so what we would do is we would save the last 15 to 20 minutes and we would actually FaceTime and do a mini debrief session and we corresponded with their lunch break so they would feel supported and be able to come in. We did almost like a messenger, a little mailbox back and forth, so that they could send messages and they always had a steady stream of updates. And we had a shared drive where the care partner could take pictures of things and write notes in the shared drive and upload the functional pictures of things around the house or thoughts that came into their mind. So when I came into the office and I knew I was seeing this patient, I could pull up the shared drive and say, oh, your garden is blooming. Okay, looks like your wife put in a picture of daffodils. She put in the hose. Okay, we're going to talk about gardening today. I see that. And then also connecting that care partner to the social worker or a social worker so that they could get set up with respite care, so they could get set up with PACE, and so they could find some community support groups to decrease that sense of isolation.
That's a really good tip to efficiently problem solve for those situations where the caregiver can't be present. So I like that, the shared drive. You have covered so much today. This has been a wonderful chat. So if we were going to just go maximum impact here, could you say three actionable takeaways for clinicians that they might want to take from this conversation?
Sure. Number one, prioritize functional communication goals and make sure they're tailored to the individual's needs and the needs of their family. Takeaway two would be implement a multimodal approach, combining traditional therapy with AAC strategies. That's super important. And then takeaway number three is to provide comprehensive support and training to these care partners, right? Treat them holistically so you can enhance the effectiveness of your intervention and make sure that when you build these families up, that once you do transition out of their lives, they're able to take these gains and generalize them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and expertise today. I wanted to give you the opportunity as we wrap up. Do you have any final words of wisdom or inspiration that you would like to leave with the audience?
Yeah, and thank you for having me. I just want the audience to remember that if you've met one person with global aphasia, you have met one person with global aphasia. It's very unique, and any intervention should be tailored to their strengths and their specific challenges. But, you know, with dedication and creativity and also that collaborative mindset, we can, as speech language pathologists and providers, make meaningful improvement in the lives of these individuals who live with global aphasia and their families.
Beautiful. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks again to Dr. Williams Wood for the insight, the clinical takeaways related to global aphasia, and really for sharing her passion with us today. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Speech Scope by MedBridge. Please be sure to subscribe and listen to more of our episodes on Spotify or on your favorite podcast platform and at medbridge.com. If you're listening outside of the MedBridge catalog and would like to access the bonus resources and receive continuing education credit, simply log into your MedBridge account and search for this episode to find the accreditation details. Speech Scope also listens to you. If there's a particular clinician that you'd like to hear from, or if you have a clinical question or challenge that you'd like to see addressed on this podcast, please let us know by leaving a comment on our Instagram posts or by emailing podcasts@medbridge.com.